Hi, this is Smriti Kirvanandan, your host for Health Forward Podcast. One of the most important things you can do for yourself is to take care of your health. Your road to discovering an all-inclusive, empathetic, and innovative healthcare ecosystem starts right now.
I found this beautiful quote. The purpose of human life is to serve and to show compassion and the will to help others. A few weeks back, I was on a walk, early morning hours, by the beach in Playa Vista. And I found a biker gently fall off his bike. He had just completed 45 miles. And he claimed that his hip was broken and he wanted me to call 911. And so I did. And within a few minutes, we had help. He was taken to the hospital. He had the surgery done the same day. And he's doing well. While the scene was unfolding in front of me, I could recall and invoke my friend, Piyush Tiwari, who has dedicated his life by running the Save Life Foundation to really bring in awareness and to help people do good with no restrictions, especially on the road in India. In this episode, we embark on a journey through the vital intersection of road safety, pedestrian awareness, and public health. We explore the often underestimated role of being a smartarian, not just behind the wheel, but also as a pedestrian. Join us as we unravel the healthcare implications of fostering responsible road habits, emphasizing how conscious behavior on foot contributes to the overall well-being of individuals and communities alike. So lace up your walking shoes and let's step into the healthcare-conscious world of road safety. Piyush, welcome to Health Forward. Such a pleasure to have you here.
Hi, Simi. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Piyush, you're here because of your resilience in using one of your most painful moments to change the lives of many. Share with us a little bit more about what happened and what brought you here.
Back in 2007, I was struck by a personal tragedy. I lost a young family member, a young cousin, to a road crash in Kanpur in India. Of course, you know, these incidents come with a significant amount of trauma because, you know, you've just seen the person, spoken to the person just, you know, in the morning, for instance, in my case, and then by afternoon, they're gone. They're and in one of the most brutal and violent manners. So, you know, this incident came as a significant shock to me. And I was so shaken by, you know, having lost someone I love that, you know, after the formalities were over, I actually went to the scene of the crash to try and figure out what happened that day. And what I learned was this, you know, my cousin who was 16 back then was returning from school. He was in a school uniform, you know, white shirt, blue trousers, black shoes, had a school bag. And at one point he attempted to cross the road. And a vehicle coming in the wrong, you know, driving in the wrong direction struck him, tried to flee the scene, and that process ran over him once again. While this entire process, you know, grievously injured him, what took his life was public inaction, you know, post the incident. So a lot of people stopped to see what was going on. A lot of people offered him water. A lot of people threw water at him so that he would stay awake. But nobody did anything that could save his life. Nobody called the police. Nobody called the ambulance. And nobody picked him up and rushed him to the hospital. And you know, after an agonizing, you know, 40, 45 minutes, you know, he passed away on the scene. So when I learned about these circumstances surrounding his death, it became unacceptable for me that we could allow someone to die like that. I wouldn't even let an animal die like that, forget about a fellow human being. And that's what really started the journey of my, you know, discovering how significant and how massive the issue of road crashes was in a country like India. And now, as we know, in many other low and middle income countries. And yeah, so it's now been 16 years that Save Life Foundation that I founded after his demise has been working on this issue. And we're on a journey to tackle and, you know, hopefully solve some of the more complex aspects of this issue.
And Piyush, thank you for sharing. And I know we opened this off with a very heavy, heavy beginning, but I think it's really important. And being born in India and, you know, I visit quite often, my biggest struggles have always been, you know, watching, you know, animals die and trying to, you know, seek help or seeing people being hurt, but concerned about, you know, family members saying, don't go and help. And, you know, a couple of weeks back when I reached out to you saying I want you on the platform is, you know, it's helping out someone who just fell off a bike. Mm-hmm. And I called the 911 and all of a sudden I had this flood of emotions. And I just felt like, and I remembered, you know, your talk in one of the sessions we were together. And I felt a sense of guilt, but also a sense of freedom of being able to help without any strings attached. And it's incredible that you not just, try to solve the problem, but you've kind of dedicated your life to actually doing this, which is, takes so much courage. And I don't think it's an easy path in India whatsoever said, but it's just incredible what you're doing.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for doing what you did that day, by calling for help and, saving that life. So it really, really appreciate you for doing that. And, I think these are the kind of things that will, go forward to create a society that will help, step forward to help each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Good Smartarian law is a law that protects bystanders to do good with more freedom and dignity. The government of India passed this in March 2016. Share with the audience a little bit more, what is the law? And obviously with intent, that how can they be practicing this?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as I mentioned, in what I discovered, after the incident in my family, was that the public inaction that we saw was not driven by apathy. It was actually driven by a very profound fear of the law. It was driven by a fear of getting entangled in a court case, many times being implicated or blamed for the incident itself, and court procedures that would go on for years and years, at times. So it was that fear that had become a culture, and it was very important to break that culture. And so it was not really an issue of creating awareness or providing training to people, all of which is important, but it was very important to create an environment that would insulate bystanders and passersby who would come forward to help an injured person like a Good Samaritan and would be insulated from any kind of legal and procedural hassles that have traditionally followed such an act. So it was this sense of confidence that had to be given that, okay, you can feel free to come forward, call for help. If you're trained, provide help, and you will not be harassed or intimidated by the system. So that's how the journey of Good Samaritan Law for India started. The initial years were, dedicated to understanding more about the issue, meeting policymakers. I got, I just thought of a ton of assurances from many policymakers that this would be done. Unfortunately, I did not see much action. So in 2012, I moved the Supreme Court of India, stating that, our fundamental right to life was being violated by this set of procedures that were creating an impediment for people to come forward and save someone's life. And, the case went on for about 4 years. We had massive opposition, especially from the police, because we were talking about devolving police powers of detention, questioning Good Samaritans, and so on and so forth. And we argued that, look, in any case, people are not stepping forward because of fear. So you're in any case not getting any witnesses or being able to investigate the crash properly. So you might as well allow at least, a chance for people to be saved by Good Samaritans, by not subjecting them to intimidation or detention or questioning. And we saw a massive amount of support that came from the public, media, Indian, Bollywood stars. And eventually, after, what was a four-year fight in the court, on 30th of March, 2016, the Supreme Court of India exercised its special powers to institute a nationwide Good Samaritan law. I do have to acknowledge that the government of India by then had recognized that this was an important aspect of saving someone's life and had withdrawn their opposition eventually and allowed the Supreme Court to set this in place. And then 3 years later, the government of India in 2019 incorporated this into a law and provided it legislative backing through the Parliament of India. And so today, if you were to step forward and help an injured person, you can do that with complete confidence without any fear of being detained or questioned or harassed or being forced to make payments at hospitals and so on and so forth. So a lot of that has now changed in the country. And we are seeing a lot of people now being rushed to hospitals by trained Good Samaritans, by people who can now use their training in CPR, C-spine immobilization, bleeding control with confidence and try to save someone's life.
This is amazing, Piyush. So congratulations on making this happen. Beyond the law, Piyush, I'm curious, right? So every time I visit India, I'm pretty sure, I'm not aware of this law until I look this up. One is, beyond the law, Are people just afraid or people immune because of the level of population? So often I hear, I remember this one incident, this story I would love to share is I was in Bangalore, I believe it was 2016. And, you know, these cats that fall off the building and they, you know, they try to land smoothly. But this cat had, you know, jumped out the building and was kind of having this fit and almost, you know, passing out. And I was upset. You know, I love animals. I'm vegan. And I was trying to call the security and I said, let's call the vet. And they were all looking at me like I was this crazy person because, you know, that I don't know that system exists. But within a few minutes, the cat, you know, started bleeding and passed away. And it's like, okay, now what? They said, what do we, you know, what do we do with this body? They said, you know, we'll just pick it up and we'll, you know, we'll dump it in the trash. And I was just shocked. And I said, absolutely not. So then I don't know what to do. So I said, no one's touching this cat because I didn't trust them at this point. So I went home, picked a bunch of towels. And, you know, my person was helping me drive back then. You know, we walked a mile or two, found like this empty land, buried the cat. And I took off from work that day because I was just so disappointed, not just disappointed that, you know, the vet didn't come or, you know, the system wasn't in place, but I was just disappointed that this living thing was just, you know, there and they didn't even have a few minutes of courtesy to just think of putting it in a proper place. It takes, you know, makes no difference in timing, makes no difference, right? Yeah. But I realized that one, they were just immune just from the reaction from the face that it was like, whatever. And it wasn't just for the cat, right? In my years visiting India and for human life, they would just walk past it without any emotional reactions. You know, people in the cars wouldn't move for the ambulance and they weren't bothered. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm always, people would always ask me, would you ever live in India? My first reaction would be, I don't want to be immune to this. But I would love to know your perspective. You're on the ground. You're doing this. Is this just a law that's pulling people back? Or do you think there's a lot of immunity and lack of empathy in some ways?
You know, I mean, I think in having now lived and worked in many parts of the world also, I can tell you that there will always be people in societies that, you know, feel that it's somebody else's job to, you know, take that step forward, right? And of course, there are societies where the awareness levels and responsibility levels are, you know, fairly high and you know, more than one person would come forward to help the injured or to help another person. In India, what you know, an analogy I would like to give you is that, you know, if you've ever heard or seen scenes from a train crash or a building collapse or even a violent act or a terrorist attack, the first people to come to the aid of those who are affected and injured are the common people. In fact, in almost every single train crash that has happened in India, a large number of victims have already been rushed to hospital by villagers even before the disaster response force or the formal authorities have, you know, reached the site. So we do see that, you know, people in India traditionally, you know, do come forward to help those in distress. But the challenge that we see is that in the case of, you know, road crash victims or in the case of people involved in interpersonal violence, if there's an injured person lying on the road, you know, there is a level of hesitation because of the fear that I mentioned to you earlier. Now, that fear, you know, is a fear that comes from generations ago, from decades ago. So when the British were in India, they amended the Bombay Police Act to ensure that not just freedom fighters who were being brought, injured freedom fighters who were being brought to the hospital, but those who were bringing the injured freedom fighters to hospital should also be booked and should also be, their details should be recorded so the police can, the British police can track them. Now that, of course, the British left and now they have, you know, of course, reformed their laws and their own systems, you know, over the years. But many of the practices that they had instituted in India, you know, continued even after they left. So it became a police practice to necessarily ask for the details of the people bringing the injured, many times call them to the police station at odd hours, subject them to court proceedings. So it had become a sort of a cultural and, you know, an acceptable thing. Mm-hmm. And it was very important to challenge that status quo, both in terms of the police procedures, but also in terms of the mindset that people had that, okay, this is how it's supposed to be. We're supposed to walk away and not be bothered to be involved in a police case and so on and so forth. So I think what the law does is not solve the problem entirely. I think the law is fundamentally a starting point. What we're able to tell people now is that, look, here is a tool that should give you confidence. But I think the generations of the kind of mindset that has been created, that of course will require more than just a law. It'll require at the school level, at the office level, college level, you know, significant amount of training in bystander care, you know, a fair amount of messaging, you know, around this. You know, you said you weren't, you know, aware about this law before you read up about it. You know, that's the same case with a large number of Indians also, you know, and so a big part of our fight is, you know, how do you tell 1.4 billion people that they have a new right, right? And do it in a manner that is, you know, cost effective and that is accessible to everyone. So I do feel that, you know, we've made some headway, but there's definitely some way to go before we can say that, yes, we have a high level of awareness. People are fundamentally using this right. They are well-trained because of the training systems that have been put into place for learning basic trauma life support skills, and that they're coming forward and using it. So yes, so I do agree that this doesn't solve the problem, but I also feel that it's a start, and, you know, because we will stick to it, we know that we will eventually over the next, you know, few years reach a stage where things will definitely be better than they are today.
Yeah, I agree with you, Piyush. And I just want to be clear with the audience that I'm not saying that India is more or less responsible compared to the United States or any other countries. It's a reflection on the population. And I sometimes feel like, you know, living in Los Angeles, we do sometimes live in, not sometimes, most of the time, right? We don't get to see this. We're, just, you know, driving the car all the time and not on our foot. Yeah. So we live in a little bit of a protected society, which is a pro and a con in many ways. So despite the law being passed, Piyush, 84% of the people are unaware of this, which we just discussed. 76% of the healthcare professionals report no action was taken for the ones who do not comply by the law. And 59% were detained while helping despite the law. What is lacking here? And what is your message to people who are listening to this?
So, you know, it was frustrating when we saw this. So this is a study we did back in 2018, but 2 years after the after the Supreme Court passed its judgment, just to see, you know, what the reach of this reform has been and, you know, how much people are aware. And these were most certainly disappointing numbers that we came across. But since then, a couple of things have happened. One is that, you know, this got legislative backing in the Parliament of India in 2019. We also partnered with some, you know, significant personalities in India, including in Bollywood, you know, for those who know Amitabh Bachchan, he's, you know, part of the campaign. So we've made some headway in terms of, you know, ensuring that the word reaches out. What has also happened is that I would say at least half of the states in India have now started reward and recognition program for Good Samaritans. Now, that's a massive cultural shift from a government perspective, right? An agency or an institution that would earlier detain people or question them for the act of helping another person is now willing to recognize them publicly for that action, right? So I think that shift is taking place. And like I said, again, I think if we do a survey today, the same survey, the numbers would not have changed dramatically. So the 84% would probably be 60%. But that's still, for a country as large as India, I think that's a very massive delta to be able to move. So we are sort of, you know, at that piece. What we're also learning is that in order to implement a policy or a law, you also have to create subsystems that will, you know, move forward. And especially in the case of health policy or, you know, something that encourages trauma care, you know, it takes a little bit of, you know, additional effort, primarily because of, you know, distributed responsibilities between the federal and the state structures. So what we're also doing is discovering these mechanisms and trying to work on them. So for instance, in the state of UP, which is the largest state of India with also the largest number of road fatalities, unfortunately, we now have a very unique, you know, grievance redressal mechanism set up by the state, where the state is guaranteeing that you can come forward and help an injured person. And we guarantee you that if you are harassed or intimidated by anyone, we will take action against them. And while they were rolling this guarantee out, they did a massive amount of, you know, promotion around this. So I think there is a lot of movement happening now around this area. And, you know, hopefully when we speak about this subject in maybe a couple of years, I think we would have seen a significant shift. The other thing is that Save Life Foundation is now advocating for a right to emergency medical care law for India. So the aspect of bystander care or Good Samaritan law will get connected to the official systems that need to exist to provide formal care to an injured person, right? And many of these systems exist, but they're disjointed at this point of time. So that effort will also lead to a push in terms of you know, survival rates, strengthening the Good Samaritan law implementation, and so on and so forth, because it'll come as part of a larger system that will hopefully get institutionalized in the next couple of years in India.
What is the emergency medical law that you're trying to parse in terms of accidents?
Yeah, actually, this goes to, you know, traumatic incidents or traumatic injury beyond road crashes. So India, on an average, every year loses about 400,000 people with traumatic injury, okay, of which about 170,000 people are due to road crashes. But the remainder are, you know, incidents involving rail crashes, drowning, falls, a large number of falls, building collapses, and so on and so forth. There's a fair amount of trauma that's happening in the country every year. Now, what the right to trauma care, or right to emergency medical care law, and we'll figure out the nomenclature soon. But what the vision behind this legislation that I have is that the process of saving someone's life, you know, we call that a chain of survival. And the reason it's called a chain of survival is because all the parts that are involved in saving someone's life must come together. So, for example, it starts by having the ability to call a universal access number like a 911. Mm-hmm. In India, we have, depending on where you are, the number is going to be different that you will have to call to ask for help, right? In many cases, there are different numbers for different agencies. Mm-hmm. So the very first effort is to create a universal access number that will be India's sole emergency number that you can call for help. And, you know, even a three-year-old will hopefully remember that number. Then once you've called for help comes the aspect of bystander care that we ensured from through the Good Samaritan law. That's when the formal care or the ambulance is making its way to the scene. What's happening to the injured person? Now, once the ambulance has arrived, is the ambulance equipped and staffed with personnel and equipment that can actually save someone's life, that can intervene in saving someone's life, and what those standards are, right? So those standards have to be established. Currently, someone with a three-month diploma can be called an EMT, and someone with a three-year diploma or three-year bachelor's degree will also be called an EMT. The hospital in itself needs to be designated from a level four to a level one trauma center. A level one trauma center is the highest, you know, category of a trauma center, and level four is the most basic. And when you know what level of the trauma center that you are taking a person to, you can expect, you know, okay, I'm taking the person to a level four trauma center. So the best they can expect is to be packaged and be readied for a longer journey to a level one trauma center. Or if I'm taking someone to a level one trauma center, we know that this person will get neurotrauma, polytrauma support, and so on and so forth. So that's what needs to happen, you know, when you're on your way to the hospital. When you get to the hospital, everything from triaging to decisive care to intensive care, even right up to rehabilitation, those pathways have to be defined that currently don't exist or have not been standardized. And then you need a trauma registry that can capture all of this data to feed into motor vehicle laws, you know, crash testing of vehicles, around road engineering, depending upon the kind of injuries being suffered. So that trauma registry then becomes your knowledge base to move the preventive care system. So this entire chain has to be a connected series of events, and that's what the vision behind this right to emergency medical care law is, that this will create the framework, the overarching framework that is required to bring all of these elements together.
It's interesting how one incident has created a ripple effect for one to look through the entire touch point of customer experience in this particular context. And apart from the framework and the laws we're trying to change, one of the most important things I love about what you're doing, and I think what I'm passionate about, is more than the affordability and the accessibility of healthcare. It's really striving to give people a life with dignity and also death with dignity. And that's really what I, you know, really love at the core of what you're really trying to do. And, you know, I know you're en route to making healthcare, emergency healthcare, much better. But so far in the 15, 16 years of your healthcare experience, on the other side of the coin, how are people injured being received in the system? And are physicians at risk as also being, you know, at a liability of helping patients? What is the other side of the coin? What's that storyline for healthcare professionals when it comes to injuries and trauma?
Yeah, you know, there are across the country, there are, you know, pockets of excellence around the aspect of trauma care. So we have the All India Institute of Medical Sciences system in Delhi and Rishikesh and many other parts of the country that is emerging as a level one care system. The challenge with this care system is that the ambulance system doesn't talk to this hospital system. The police system doesn't talk to the ambulance system. The numbers to be called you know, unless you call directly the ambulance service, that piece remains disjointed. So while, you know, the ambulance services in India have improved through the 108 system, 108 ambulance system, which is the number for ambulance in many states in the country, the linkages in the system are, you know, is what remains part of the challenge. Even when we come to physicians, right, the emergency medicine as a field of medicine got recognized for education only as recently as 2009. Okay. So we don't really have as many specialists in emergency medicine as a country like India must have, given the volume of trauma that we are facing, right? So that remains, you know, similarly trauma surgeons. There are a handful of trauma surgeons in the country. And when I say handful, I'm speaking in the context of India. I mean, the numbers might be very large for a smaller country, but from the context of India, you know, the number of trauma surgeons are limited. Emergency medicine specialists are limited. So even from a physician standpoint, we are only now beginning to build capacity in this area. And it will take a few years for us to reach a stage where we have a US equivalent, you know, trauma care from a physician standpoint, services available. The aspect of liability of doctors in this entire space, it's a very interesting question, because when we were working on the aspect of Good Samaritan law, we realized that in many cases, even doctors, especially in private institutions, are oftentimes, you know, made witnesses in the case, are, you know, brought into the court, not from a liability perspective, but even from a witness perspective. And while, you know, it's a duty to be a witness in a case or to help the delivery of justice, the time period for which these people are involved, you know, could last decades. So it becomes a huge impediment again for medical professionals. So a few years ago, Save Life worked with the state of Karnataka to pass Karnataka's first ever law, which was called Protection of Good Samaritans and Medical Professionals in Emergency Situations Bill. That law fundamentally not only protects the Good Samaritans from legal hassles, but also the doctors and the physicians and the medical staff that is, you know, trying to assist an injured person or a trauma victim from any kind of ensuing legal and procedural hassles. And it fundamentally does that by designating medical professionals as official witnesses, which means that they can give their statements to an affidavit as opposed to appearance in a court. So it does. So now what we're hoping is that now that we've formed a precedent with Karnataka, we are hoping that other states in India, because health is a state subject, other states in India will also enact similar laws to protect their medical professionals and enable faster care with lesser, you know, paperwork and procedures that many doctors get into just to protect themselves, right? Of course, while keeping in mind the importance of, or balancing the importance of some level of documentation or parallel documentation in this space.
Yeah, very interesting. I know, Piyush, you mentioned the United States Emergency Room. This is a public platform, but it's a safe space. So, you know, working in the U.S. healthcare, you know, we have a lot of physician burnout, right? So we had 900,000 mm-hmm. physicians, maybe a year back. I think this year we have 800,000 physicians. At least 60% have reported to experience depression, anxiety. This was even pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. So, you know, post-COVID, it's even more. So I don't think the healthcare system in the U.S. is any much better or less than, you know, right. any other country. I just think, you know, we all have, you know, changes to make and really be honest about where we are, regardless of how, right. you know, economically powerful the country is. So, you know, that's mm-hmm. one point for the listeners here. And, you know, the other interesting part you just mentioned, you know, a lot of the work we're doing now, despite of all these issues, is really using emerging technologies to reduce the workforce mm-hmm. burnout and to really accelerate this, right? So when we talk about the paperwork, right. the, you know, informing the physicians or the legal teams and, you know, all this other stuff, we're really using generative AI, we're using predictive data mm-hmm. analytics insights. So how do you see integrating these technologies, one, in the work you're doing, and where is that in healthcare? Do you think India needs to be really pressing the acceleration button?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is a very interesting question again, because I don't think that we are formally documenting, you know, things like physician burnouts. There's definitely, and having done work on the ground in this area now, and at least auditing what some of these services look like, we know that there is a massive dearth of qualified professionals in this space across the country. And so we know that the pressure on those who are currently serving the system is, you know, massively, you know, must be fairly high. But I don't think that there's a formal system of documenting, you know, physician burnouts or even reporting such things. So I think there is definitely the need to create some level of ecosystem around this so that we can ensure that these things start getting documented. Technology can significantly enhance the current scenario because when we talk about trauma care, for example, having defined pathways, ensuring that, you know, documentation, for example, can be done using AI or, you know, machine learning algorithms so that that work becomes faster. There's lesser load on physicians in terms of the documentation that adds to their work hours. We know that, you know, predictive analysis can play a significant role in prevention of injury. So, for example, the whole trauma registry piece, once you have enough data available, you can most certainly run it through predictive analysis and start bringing out insights that can, you know, preemptively do things from police enforcement preemptively at certain areas to optimize the placement of ambulances, improving outcomes in terms of the response times and, you know, so on and so forth. So there's definitely a massive opportunity there. We've heard of drones, you know, delivering defibrillators to far-flung areas in the event of an emergency, again, with the intention of improving outcomes before somebody is rolled into a hospital. So yes, there is a big, big opportunity there. I do feel that it is important for some sort of a system to be established for, you know, this these technologies to be used and harnessed. And one of the ways of doing that is to link up the data available to digital public infrastructure, make a lot of this data, you know, openly accessible so that startups can work on, you know, problem solving, you know, government agencies can look at it in a more holistic manner and so on and so forth. So right now, the challenge that I see in this area is that the data is held by a few and is not publicly available for problem solving efforts or solutioning or innovation to come through. So definitely there is a need to transform all of that into a digital public asset and link up to a DPI system so that more people can benefit from the learnings that we've had over the last, you know, many, many years.
You know, Piyush, I don't know how many hours you have, but the whole conversation about data, the integration, the availability, I think is a universal problem, right? So when Prakash, I was here and, you know, I was hearing all this news from India that's all under control. And every other country in the world was like, how is India having everything under control for such a large population? And then 6 months later, you know, hell broke loose because the data wasn't documented. It was false information, right? And the same thing came out. One of my friends, I was having a conversation with him. He said, you know, the divorce rates in the US are 60 to 70%, but in India, it's one person. I said, you mean the documented one person? Because where do you, like, how do you get the data documented is one. But the other problem is with every solution, I think in every country, there's 10 problems that comes with it, is the accessibility, right? The technology accessibility, the internet accessibility, and, you know, the other issues. So I think, you know, for anyone listening, I think the first concern is economic empowerment. The second one is really making internet and technology accessible and, you know, educate people on that, right? And I think then we are on this ripple effect of making, you know, solve all these issues in more sustainable and longitudinal format. But I just wanted to share the story of, you know, how I'm always surprised when I hear about India having everything in control. And I'm like, I don't think so. I think it's, you know, the undocumented version is under control.
Yeah, there's definitely some way to go there.
Yeah. You know, Piyush, I think with great goodness comes a lot of pain. I would love to hear, you know, personally, I think this is, you know, if I were doing the work you were doing, I don't know if I would sleep well, right? Because I think I'm, you know, one, understanding the trauma and trying to really move the needle. You're in a position where you're working, you know, with the politicians, the private sector, and every other, you know, campaign possible. What are your personal challenges that you're facing? And obviously, what are your greatest hopes that you're hoping to see happen?
You know, it is one of the challenges at Save Life, you know, that all of us face every day is the necessity to confront trauma, right? And it's not easy because, you know, we're looking at postmortem reports every other day. We're looking at horrific images coming from road crashes almost every day. So, you know, one does have to ensure that, you know, there is most certainly a space to reflect on some of these incidents and process some of this trauma that we are seeing almost every single day. So we've created some internal systems to address some of those issues. But, you know, fundamentally, I think I'm an eternal optimist. And I think that's the only reason why I've survived in this space for 15 plus years, because I do believe that things will change. And because we've seen some things change, right? We've seen, you know, over the years, the number of people being brought to the hospital by Good Samaritans has increased. We have seen how, you know, it is possible to reduce fatalities on some of the deadliest roads in the country by taking a comprehensive approach to, you know, road traffic safety. We've seen how our crash investigation work has led to the reform in India's crash testing mechanism for our vehicles. So all of these things give me a fair amount of optimism that the path that we've taken, though extremely traumatic and hard, I think is eventually leading to some place which will leave it, you know, better than what we started off with. So yeah, I think that's fundamentally, I know it's more of a philosophical answer than what I would typically give. But
no, I think that's
optimism that takes me forward.
I think it's important because I was just listening to this talk by Isaacson, who had followed Elon Musk and Steve Jobs and written their biography. And one of the key pointers he pointed was, you know, they were all obsessed and very stubborn about making the change and really see it happening too, right? So I love that you're obsessed with making the good happen. And, you know, we need the positivity to keep the hope going. If not, I think it's really tough. So I think I think it's a great answer. So this brings us to our last question, Piyush. Three takeaways for the future of health on roads. What would that be?
The very first is that we have to start treating road crashes as a public health issue. And only when we start doing that will we start looking at the diagnosis first. And when we start looking at the diagnosis, we will start developing mechanisms that will allow us to understand the issue a lot more deeply. Currently, what happens is that after almost any crash, it is usually the driver who will be blamed almost immediately, and it will be the driver of a bigger vehicle who might be blamed almost immediately from an India perspective, and many other low and middle income countries, right? So what we need to do is to first designate this as a public health issue that's taking 430 people each day, you know, injuring almost 10 times more, and, you know, creating massive havoc in our socioeconomic setup. That's the first thing. The second piece is that we must replicate what works. I think a lot of effort has happened now in terms of testing what, you know, whether it's the Western practices, whether it's something that needs to come out from within, you know, our countries that works. And so now we now know what works, right? And I think there has to be replication on a war footing and scaling on a war footing simply because of just the massive amount of trauma that, you know, this issue is delivering on the world. 1.4 million people dying every single year in, you know, around the world, and 93% of them from low and middle income countries talks about, you know, how significant this issue is. And the third piece is that we have to approach this issue, you know, with a fair amount of positivity. And the reason I'm saying that is because we have dealt with issues like polio, like HIV, like tuberculosis with a fair amount of, you know, success. And so because there are precedents available of dealing with massive, complex public health issues in the past, there's no reason why this can't be resolved as well. So I think there is a massive need for hope that, you know, we can definitely solve this, and we are most certainly going to, not in decades, but in a much more, you know, reasonable amount of time than one would like to believe.
Piyush, thank you for being here, and really grateful for what you're doing, especially bringing in hope and dignity and, you know, being obsessed with making the good changes. Thank you so much for being a part of Health Forward.
Simi, thanks so much for having me, and thank you so much for bringing this issue to light to your listeners and beyond. So thank you so much once again for having me.
Thank you for listening. This is Health Forward Podcast, and I'm your host, Smriti Kirbanandi.